But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they say they don't know what in it. They say they don't know what in it, and it makes some people sick. Because me, when I had it, I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. He's not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. And people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now. You see? A lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something, I don't know. But for me, no.
The black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic, that we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange. Qasimi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together, to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes, right laws which favor tenants and not landlords, put more tax revenue into building new housing, and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the yellow vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices. Paris.
Families waiting outside the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. For hundreds, sometimes more, this bus stop is the stopover, perhaps a waiting area. All they wait for is the appointment with doctors. Few I spoke with don't care about the new COVID outbreak, and many are even confused what it is and what it does. They say our loved ones are dying anyway due to lack of treatments and medical assistance. Coronavirus cases driven by the new Omicron variant have skyrocketed in India, prompting the government to rapidly reinforce a series of restrictions. The administration of Prime Minister Modi says it is confident and fully geared up to handle any situation in the wake of new COVID outburst, largely driven by Omicron variant. Health experts, however, have urged the government to halt the ongoing election campaigns, which they say could spark another healthcare crisis in the country. On Tuesday, the country recorded 168,000 new infections, including 4,400 cases of Omicron variant. 227 deaths were also reported, based on official data. The overall COVID case tally has increased to around 35 million, while the death count rose close to 480,000. And overall recoveries stand at 34.5 million. We take things lightly, as usual. And we saw the result in April. Many people think this Omicron is nothing new, but we need to be cautious. Despite alarming rise in fresh COVID cases, the political parties are busy with election rallies ahead of crucial state polls in five key Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Punjab, Uttarakhand, Goa and Manipur, which begins February 10. Rallies packed with thousands of people, many without masks, is making health experts worried.
We have learned from first and second wave, and even if we see the private and the public sectors and health sector basically in India, so everyone have leveled up their care practices, and they are also providing the specialized care for the COVID.
Over the last 2 weeks, hospital admissions are rising and medical staff has been advised to cut their leaves. New Delhi, Maharashtra, Rajasthan and parts of southern India are reporting maximum cases, including the new variant. Earlier waves of the pandemic unfolded mayhem in the subcontinent. Healthcare collapsed. People begged for oxygen and hospital beds. Graveyards and crematoriums ran out of space. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The pandemic appears to be spiraling out of control in the United States, pushing the country into uncharted territory. Many states are witnessing a dramatic surge in infections. Just in a single day, two new records have been set, sounding the alarm about the severity of the situation. Authorities are now reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The previous record set last week was just a little above 1 million. The 7-day average has also been soaring in recent weeks. It's now over 700,000 cases a day, 3 times higher than 2 weeks ago. Deaths have also increased, averaging around 1,700 per day, That's 20% up from 1,400 posted in recent days. Omicron is largely to blame for the rise. The extremely contagious variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, and the US is no exception. It's the world's worst-hit nation by far, with around 62 million cases and over 800,000 deaths. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. U.S. medical centers are already overwhelmed, and the Omicron wave is now pushing them to the brink. The number of daily hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 more patients are being treated in hospitals whose staff have already been worn out by the Delta variant. Experts are of the opinion that many Americans' refusal to get their shots is probably one key factor stoking the spike. About 37% of the population has not been fully vaccinated. Some cities like Chicago and New York are imposing restrictions and vaccination rules to curb the trend, the kind of measures that are likely to once more bring anti-vaxxers onto the streets. Whatever the causes may be, the facts speak for themselves. The battle against the coronavirus is a tough one, and the U.S., already the number one in many global categories, has now one more to add to its records, the world's number one in its failure against the virus.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S., and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
Around 10:30 at night, Mahmoud was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Puriza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a high rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As coal power is phased out in favour of cheaper renewable energy, the fossil fuel's future looks bleak. Yet coal is making a comeback as it helps power post-pandemic recoveries. Amid a worldwide energy crisis, global coal power emissions are surging to pre-pandemic highs, especially in China and India. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Deutsche Welle journalists Stuart Braun, Ruby Russell, and Jennifer Collins. Coal power is phased out in favour of cheaper renewable energy, the fossil fuel's future looks bleak. yet coal is making a comeback as it helps power post-pandemic recoveries. Amid a worldwide energy crisis, global coal power emissions are surging to pre-pandemic highs, especially in China and India. Rising oil and gas prices and the onset of winter have conspired with the energy needs of rebounding post-COVID-19 economies to increase coal demand after a long decline. The renaissance of the most carbon-intensive fossil fuel was further reinforced when a commitment to a coal phase-out in the Glasgow Climate Pact was weakened to a phase-down. Going into COP26, the UK president of the conference, Alok Sharma, said he hoped the summit would consign coal power to history in a bid to keep global warming to around 1.5 degrees Celsius rise. That didn't quite happen, though. A green light for more coal production was how former Australian Resource Minister Matt Canavan responded to the last-minute diluting of the plan to exit coal. The countries in our region, like India, like China, like Southeast Asia, are growing and developing their industries, and their demand for coal almost has no limit, he said in a television interview. Experts admit that the weakened language in the Glasgow Agreement could muddy the broader momentum towards a coal phase-out by 2030 or 2040 at the latest. But the current spike in coal demand will be short-term phenomena linked to a strong post-lockdown economic rebound, believes Katharina Hillenbrand von der Neyen, head of the research at climate think tank Carbon Tracker. I would strongly caution against any view that this is the revival of coal. Von der Neyen expects coal to revert to its pre-COVID slide driven by cheaper renewable energy, including in China, which generated over half of the world's coal-fired power in 2020. The structural trend is for steeply falling load factors, she said, meaning that with the competition from renewable energy, coal plants aren't running at full capacity, rendering them unprofitable. While new coal power plants are being built, they contribute to an oversupply that only exacerbates the problem. As a result, 27% of the global coal fleet has become unviable, according to Carbon Tracker. If I could put all my eggs into the coal basket again, you might find they drop onto the floor quite quickly, said Katharina Hillenbrand von der Neyen of coal's precipitous long-term outlook. Gaurav Ganti, a researcher with Berlin-based think tank Climate Analytics, agrees. This short-lived renaissance is unlikely to persist, given strong headwinds from low-cost renewable energy, he said. Even as China and India power their COVID recovery with coal, the fact remains that the number of planned new coal power plants has declined by 76% since 2015, when the Paris Climate Accord was signed, according to the climate change think tank E3G. This is equivalent to China's whole coal capacity. China provided about 75% of global coal investment in 2020. However, its decision in September of this year to end funding of coal projects beyond its shores and to peak its own coal use by 2025 as part of its 2060 net zero emissions plan is a further signal of coal's inevitable demise, said Gaurav Ganti. However, there is no room for complacency, he added. Even despite the broader commitment by 47 countries at COP26 summit to phase out coal via the Global Coal to Clean Power Transition Statement, our work indicates that keeping to 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, the warming limit of the Paris Climate Accord, requires coal-fired power to be phased out by 2030 in developed economies and by 2040 globally. Developing countries will require substantial international support for ditching coal. And despite the Glasgow conference backing away from the firm language on ending coal, individual countries are bringing their phase-out deadlines forward. Germany's new governing coalition, comprising of Social Democrats, SDP, Greens and the Free Democrats, the FDP, is aiming for a 2030 coal exit, 8 years ahead of the country's previous schedule. Germany is Europe's second largest coal consumer and producer, but even amid a nuclear energy phase-out, it already managed to halve coal power consumption between 2010 and 2020. And while it's true that coal energy demand has also spiked in Germany in 2021, this was due in part to unusually poor weather conditions for wind and solar power. Along with other European Union nations and the United States, Germany is also helping to finance a coal phase-out in South Africa, which produces 90% of its energy from coal and is the biggest emitter of the fossil fuel in Africa. Germany's then Environment Minister described the $8.5 billion initiative agreed to in the Glasgow summit to fund the shift from coal to clean energy as a potential blueprint for other regions of the world. Meanwhile, Portugal this week completely stopped burning coal for energy, 2 years ahead of a planned phase-out. Fossil fuel powerhouse Ukraine has also committed to ending coal power generation by 2035, or by 2040 at the latest. At the COP26 summit, the country joined the Powering Past Coal Alliance, a coalition of national governments, businesses and organizations committed to an accelerated coal exit. Researchers are warning that governments who stick with coal could be set to lose billions in stranded assets, as well as hundreds of thousands of jobs, as the world decarbonizes to limit heating to below 2 degrees Celsius. A stranded asset is something that had value or generated income but no longer does. According to a June 2021 report, one-third of coal mines in Europe, North America and Australia will become stranded assets by 2040 if countries meet their climate targets. Australia, for example, could lose $25 billion per year in this scenario. Globally, 2.2 million jobs could be at risk unless countries act quickly to transition to a cleaner energy system. But economics is not the only motivation to get out of coal. Governments face a choice here, said Gaurav Ganti. Invest in fossil fuels of yesterday and risk stranded assets, or invest in renewable energy to get us to a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise pathway.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has noted very good progress in Sino-Iranian talks on the expansion of bilateral relations, saying that strategic issues will be discussed during his visit to China, including the implementation of the Tehran-Beijing economic agreements. The two countries will begin implementing a 25-year mutual partnership agreement, which they signed in March last year in defiance of the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions. In another development, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is to visit Russia soon. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has described the upcoming visit as, quote, very significant. In tonight's Spotlight, we'll discuss Iran's look to the East policy as the country has been experiencing decades-long hostility by the U.S., the EU, and their regional allies.
Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, has met with his Chinese counterpart in Beijing to begin implementing a 25-year strategic partnership the two countries signed last year. It is the first time Iran's foreign minister visited China under the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi, who prioritizes improving ties with the East. Upon arriving in Beijing, Amir Abdollahian said he had had telephone calls and meetings with his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi more than 7 times over the past 4 months. The visit comes at a time when Iran and the world powers, including China, have convened in Vienna in a bid to revive their 2015 agreement, known as the JCPOA. The deal was supposed to remove sanctions on Iran in exchange for nuclear curbs. However, it almost unraveled after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018. The new Iranian administration has made it clear that its major policies, including neutralizing sanctions on Iran, would not be tied to the ongoing talks in Vienna. Part of the neutralization efforts is the look to the East policy, which includes expanding relations with powers in the East, including China and Russia. Upon arriving at China, Amir Abdollahian said strategic issues are on the agenda of his talks with Chinese officials. And prior to his visit, the Iranian foreign minister penned an article for the leading China's Global Times. He had this to say regarding the talks in Vienna. No matter what happens in the field of international relations, China and Iran, along with their trade and regional partners, will be on the right side of history forever. In another development, the Iranian president is also scheduled to visit Russia in the near future. On Friday, the Russian foreign minister described Raisi's visit to Russia as very significant. The signs of growing economic ties among the trio are already there. Members of the Chinese-Russian-led Shanghai Cooperation Organization voted unanimously last September to elevate Iran to full membership. Iran's look to the East policy has been regarded with concern in Western media. Foreign Policy said, the United States can no longer ignore the Iran-China ties, adding that additional Chinese investment will increasingly mitigate the effectiveness of Washington sanctions on Tehran. China has already vowed to invest $400 billion in Iran's economy over a 25-year period in exchange for a steady supply of Iranian oil. Under the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi, Iran has been seeking a warming of ties with countries such as India, China, and Russia in the East, as well as its neighbors in West Asia. The foreign policy shift comes after years of nuclear talks with the West that practically had little advantage for the Islamic Republic, and decades-old U.S. and EU sanctions that had aimed to undermine Iran's independent foreign policy.
Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political commentator Abbas Aslani, who's joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. And geopolitical analyst Daniel Patrick Welch, joining us from Boston.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Aslani in Tehran. Please give us your views on the significance of the Iranian foreign minister's trip to China, also having in mind the escalating standoff in Southeast Asia between the U.S. and China.
Thank you for having me. In fact, the visit by Iranian foreign minister to China is preluding a visit by Iranian president to Russia in the coming days. And this indicates that Iran is shifting more toward the east in order to have more economic cooperation with the countries. The 25-year agreement with China was the focal point in the discussions between Iranian foreign minister as well as his Chinese counterpart, and they somehow announced the beginning of the implementation of the deal, which is very important. If you look at the, let's say, reaction from the West, how worried they are about this cooperation, I think this can in some ways indicate the significance of the relationship between Iran and China, because in a world that we are seeing a new actors emerging and China becoming a major economic power in the world, it seems that maybe the order in the world is changing, and that's why important for other actors, including Iran, in order to have more cooperation with those new coming powers. And, you know, Iran and China, they can share some other reasons to cooperate. They have something in common, which is the pressure and the sanctions by the United States. They are the powers who oppose the, let's say, the pressures or the role or the disruptive role is played by other powers in the world. So that's why they have why they can find common grounds to cooperate. And the implementation of this 25-year agreement can set the ground for a new era in economic cooperation between the two countries, including on oil and gas area as well as industry and other fields as well. So this is just a beginning, and these two countries are eyeing, let's say, the lifting of the sanctions. If there is any deal in Vienna, their cooperation can increase. China, in 2021, the reports say that it increased its oil import from Iran and Venezuela for more than about 53% comparing to the previous year. So if this continues, it seems that the volume of trade between Tehran and Beijing can continue to increase.
Sure, let's cross over to Boston now, Mr. Welch. Let's talk about some of the pressing issues the two countries have on their agenda right now. Specifically, we can talk about economic and energy ties. As you know, a 25-year strategic agreement was signed between Iran and China last year. What would a boost in economic, energy, and trade relations between Tehran and Beijing mean? We know that a lot could be riding on those avenues.
Well, I think it's absolutely mind-blowing. It is something, it's so significant that, as my colleague there said, you'll see the West response be ever shriller and ever louder as they are threatened by increased cooperation between China, Iran, Russia, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. All of these ties are part of a global effort by all the non-Western powers to get around what is essentially a medieval siege mentality on the part of the U.S. and its own allies. It's threatening, it's destabilizing, it's dangerous. And this can be nothing but hopeful for not only the people of Iran, but for everyone who is trying to see some light at the end of the enormous long tunnel that the U.S. has built around the rest of the world.
And Mr. Aslani, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has an upcoming trip to Russia. The president had promised in the past a more comprehensive, quote-unquote, look to the east. The Islamic Republic seems to be moving in that very direction, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Iran president has said that his administration's foreign policy will be a balanced one. And if you look at what is happening in Vienna with the negotiations that are ongoing, it seems that Iran is pursuing lifting of the sanctions. And on the other side, as they have put in terms of, let's say, neutralizing the sanctions on the other side. Neutralizing sanctions will need, let's say, more cooperation with those countries who are opposing the unilateral and illegal sanctions of the United States. And lifting of them will require the talks that are happening in Vienna. So that's why they have decided to somehow pursue a balanced foreign policy, which is happening now. This is something, I think, even if the sanctions are lifted, Iran will more benefit from the economic cooperation with the East, because the record and the past tells us the Western major companies, they will be hesitant to work with Iran. That's why I think this direction is moving toward more cooperation between Iran and the East. The projects that the East might have in future, like the Belt and Road Initiative by China, if they want to have, let's say, access to the Central Asia, or if they want to have more presence in the region, they will need to have more cooperation with Iran. And I think the region is awaiting more active role by China in the region, and we can see the role that the Russia is playing in the region. So any cooperation and coordination in the region can benefit all these countries who have something in common, and that is the hegemony of the United States that they counter against. So that's why I think Iran, for the past months that we have a new administration in office, they have tried to be in more coordination with those Eastern powers, namely China and Russia.
Mr. Welch, an analyst that we spoke to here a while back said we could actually be seeing the dawn of a new phase of unity in the Eurasian region, specifically with the appalling exit of the U.S. from Afghanistan. Do you see it in that light as well?
Absolutely. I think that that is a dawning of a new age of human history on this planet, actually. I hate to sound either so hopeful or Pollyanna-ish about it, but this is the fruit that is born of the poisonous tree that U.S. hegemony has nurtured for a century. It is high time, way beyond time, for everyone outside of the U.S.'s domination unite and push back against unreasonable sanctions, which are basically a form of war by other means, and they're murderous, and they have been incredibly difficult for the people of Iran. And the fact that this is happening is only the latest kind of page on this script. This has been happening for the last 20 years with China's enormous economic rise, and therefore its need to protect itself, its people, its investments, its partnerships, its political ties and economic bonds with not only its direct neighbors, but neighbors all over the world. We talked about increasing oil imports from Venezuela. These are people that are under enormous pressure from the United States that has racked their economies. And China has played a uniquely positive role in bringing about some sort of a change. I think we are seeing, as I don't want to say it out loud, but we are seeing the death knell of American imperialism. It will take a while. There will be many, many more bumps along the way. But the enormous significance of these developments just cannot be overstated.
Back to Tehran, Mr. Aslani. Iran was recently granted full membership at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. How significant is an SCO membership of Iran, and what are the implications for Iran across the board economically and politically? Let's not lose sight of the fact that this development came despite the continuation of the so-called maximum pressure policy by the United States.
Well, I think this indicates that the willingness by Tehran to increase cooperation and expand ties with the Eastern powers is not just a one-sided road, but the other parties are also willing to cooperate more with Tehran, because they welcome Tehran's full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, because China and Russia, as influential members of that organization paved the way for Iran's membership in the bloc. And this was, let's say, for the first time since the Iranian revolution that Iran was becoming member of a security bloc in the region or in the world, and that was quite significant. And, you know, we have something, some reasons that between Iran, China, and Russia, and other countries in the region to cooperate more, that is based on the economic maybe needs Iran or the other parties might have. But we have been hearing something under the name of triple containment by the Americans against countries in the region who are pursuing independent policies. Countries like Iran and Russia and China, this is something which we have been hearing from Americans to counter these countries who are not, let's say, obeying what the U.S. wants to impose to other countries in the region. So, you know, cooperating in different formats and levels can be very important, like cooperation and coordination in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, economically, security-wise, and politically, or when it comes to even nuclear negotiations in Vienna. These three countries try to consult frequently together in order to somehow support each other. When it comes to other issues in the region, look what is happening in Syria, Iran, and Russia. They have been cooperating for the past years. Or they had, let's say, joint military drill, a couple of years ago, and we have been hearing there might be a similar drill in the maybe near future as well. So they have tried to define new fronts or fields for more cooperation. And, you know, as the developments are, or new developments are emerging in the world, including in the region, I think this is a must for all these countries. And with the, let's say, tensions we are seeing between Russia and NATO and U.S., or we are seeing challenges between the United States and China, or the other developments we are seeing that some new independent mechanisms or blocs or organizations are being shaped who can play a role and form developments in the region or other parts right. of the world independent of the will of the United States and its partners.
Mr. Welch, the Iranian president, he's called unilateral sanctions a big challenge to the world today. He says the domineering states have been using them as a tool to impose their will over others, and the sanctions are even preventing regional cooperation. Do you think that stronger bonds between the likes of Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing, they can tackle these challenges and counter the unilateral sanctions?
Well, I think they have no choice, and the outcome can only be that which you stated, to go around these sanctions through regional and cross-border cooperation. The sanctions, the idea of unilateral sanctions is a medieval one. It is meant to end run international cooperation, meant to go around the UN Security Council, meant to go around every bit of law and order that has been established since the founding of the UN. And it's the bully in the playground, and that has been so destructive to the economies of all these targeted countries around the world that it's a matter of survival. Now the Western propaganda matrix will spin that and try to portray it as aggression, which they always do. But you can see from this period in history that these countries are just trying to survive and to thrive, and linking up with each other on all these different levels of cooperation is the only means to do that. There is no way around someone who is trying to get you and is using their economic and military might to that end. The whole concept of negotiating with the West over the sanctions and the nuclear program was doomed from the start because the U.S. is still fighting the Iranian Revolution. They have never accepted the fact that Iran is an independent country, not owned by their oil companies. And so there really isn't anywhere else to go but elsewhere. Now, Iran is smart, and it's like we've heard talked about here. It's a balanced policy. They're not going to kick out the Europeans. The Europeans are going to push back against the Americans because guess what? Everyone wants to make money. Look at what is happening with Xinjiang in China, where the U.S. said anyone who does this is going to, you know, we're going to have sanctions on them too, you know. And okay, so the next day, McDonald's opens up in Xinjiang, and the China forces Dow, I forget who it was, to strike some of the language on their website that said that they didn't do business with China in that region. And they're flexing their own muscle for survival, and that's exactly how it should be.
Mr. Hassani, I want to bring the same notion to you. What these countries, they have in common, as mentioned by President Raisi, is opposition to unilateralism. Are the U.S. sanctions and Washington's enmity actually binding more countries together?
Well, this idea was brought up months ago in Iran under the name of, let's say, the Club of Countries Against the Sanctions, meaning that the more countries are becoming sanctioned by the United States, the more, let's say, decide that they are to cooperate together in order to oppose and in order to bypass and in order to, more importantly, to make those sanctions ineffective. The United States has imposed sanctions on Iran as well as on Russia and China and other countries, Venezuela. And these countries, you can see that Iran sends shipments of, let's say, fuel to Venezuela and other parts of the world. You can see that China is importing oil from Iran. You can see that Russia and Iran are cooperating on different aspects. There are other, let's say, areas that these countries can cooperate as well. Look what is happening in Afghanistan. The situation in Afghanistan is what the region has inherited from the what the United States has done in the region and in that country. So Afghanistan is also one of those important areas that these countries can cooperate for more stability in that country, because stability in Afghanistan is important for Iran, who is a neighboring country to Afghanistan, as well as to China and to Russians as well.
Right.
The region for the security and stability of the transit of the energy in the region is very important for them. And they can cooperate on, let's say, politically as well as on economy and energy, as well as the security issues in the region when it comes to Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and other areas. These are very different, let's say, diverse areas that can be subject to the cooperation by all these countries.
All right, sorry to jump in there. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, Mr. Abbas Sassoni, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran.